Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 1st, 2015. Can you believe it, DR? Anyway, today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. DR Tucker. How are you doing on this October 1st?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. I had some pumpkin soup from lunch in the cafeteria today, so that particularly means we're in fall has arrived.
It's the great pumpkin, Charlie Brown. Okay,
the great pumpkin. So, dear, last week we talked about a story that had appeared in the front of the Boston Globe. And again, it's while it's a Massachusetts specific story, I think it's one that has consequence for many, or will, could easily have consequence and lessons learned for a lot of people in a lot of places. Turns out that a nuclear power plant that's just south of Boston called the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, because it's located in Plymouth, where the Pilgrims landed, that power plant has been around for 40 years and is essentially on its last legs, right? It's been downgraded by the Nuclear Regulatory Commissions to being a relatively unsafe plant. The fixes that are going to be called for are quite expensive, and there's every possibility that the company that owns it, called Exelon, is simply going to shutter it, turn it off. Which, to people who have opposed nuclear power, sounds great, and I would tend to agree. It's a good thing to get rid of nuclear power. But what it does is it presents a 645-megawatt hole in power production in the state of Massachusetts. And it will cause some distress, because that's a lot of power to replace. So there's discussions around, you know, what could we do? Well, one thing you could do is have the state, for example, subsidize the repairs. And we could pay hundreds of millions of dollars to Exelon to fix up their nuclear power plant and keep it going so that we have electricity. But I want to present a different idea. So we, in a few minutes, we'll talk about the new clean energy plans that are percolating through the legislature. There were just hearings on it the other day. But the fact that essentially out of the blue, 14% of Massachusetts's electricity, which is what this power plant produces, is going to simply vanish and go offline, is a great, both a crisis and an opportunity. It is a chance for climate hawks to jump up and down and say, no way to build a, to keep Pilgrim alive. We're not going to build new coal-powered plants. This is the chance to go all in and develop clean energy to replace that nuclear power plant. And I did the arithmetic, DR. It's not so bad. It turns out that the Pilgrim nuclear power station generates 645 megawatts of power on a, you know, on an average. It has that capability. Cape Wind, the wind turbine plant that was going to be in Nantucket Sound, was going to produce 170 megawatts of power on an average basis every day. So that means that instead of spending a lot of money making a new nuclear power plant or building new coal plants, if we just built four Cape Wind projects, we could replace that nuclear power plant. I mean, it's and you say, oh my God, well, Cape Wind, it took us 14 years and never got built. You'll never get four. I say, I have to call shenanigans on that. If Massachusetts wanted to, between solar power and wind power, I bet we could easily build that much wind capability over the next 2 or 3 years and say goodbye to the Pilgrim Point power plant.
I guess you can say that the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. I mean, you have so much potential in wind power and offshore wind and onshore wind as well. And again, you have, as I've been saying for a long time now, the potential to make Massachusetts not just the national leader, but literally the world leader in clean energy. And why would you not take advantage of that opportunity? It's a no-brainer, basically.
And so that's where the philosophical argument comes in. And DR, you in fact, submitted testimony to the hearing at the State House the other day about clean energy. But here in Massachusetts, Governor Baker is a, well, I don't know what the word is, a budgetary hawk, a financial guy, right? He used to run a big health care program, and he was involved with a big dig, so he's kind of a numbers guy when it comes to money. And his focus, the focus of the Baker administration, I think by its own admission, is they want the lowest cost power now, right? They've got their green eye shades on and their sharp pencil, and they're trying to figure out where they're going to get the cheapest power into Massachusetts. And of course, they're looking up at Hydro-Québec to try and bring in cheap power. Whole other story, but I guess I'd go back to what you just said. It's not about green eye shades and the bottom line. This is about leadership and investment in the future. Leadership in the sense of leading the state into the future, into a good future, and not simply minimizing the cost to electricity, the big electricity users.
Exactly. And there have been a number of reports about Governor Baker's sort of ideas for energy in the hearing that occurred on September the 29th at the State House. And one of the great reports was by a fellow by the name of Bruce Maule for Commonwealth Magazine. And they discussed the controversy surrounding what some have suggested is a predilection or a preference or perhaps even a fixation on the part of the Baker administration for hydropower as the sort of the cleanest and most cost-effective form of clean energy, and a number of members of the state legislature pointing out that hydropower might not be as cheap or as reliable or as effective as it's being hyped up to be, and that and that increasing and maximizing solar energy's potential in the state and moving to offshore and onshore wind would be a more reliable bet. And the Baker administration and Baker are suggesting that, somehow there might be cost effectiveness issues with offshore and onshore wind. And the response from the state legislatures is that that's sort of an argument built around the idea of knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing, that there is so much value in terms of job creation and in terms of, yes, reducing energy bills and, yes, meeting the targets of the Global Warming Solutions Act, that, again, going to offshore and onshore wind seems to be the most logical choice, but a choice that the Baker administration
Is li
seems to have an
well,
issue with.
I saw there were some reports that said the governor would think about long-term offshore leasing, that he was sort of hedging his bets all of a sudden and considering. I mean, I would prefer a more full-throated support of renewable energies. But I mean, maybe the ice is breaking. There's cracks in the facade somewhere deep in the bowels of the State House where they're thinking that I mean, I hope. I think it was Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, who's quoting someone else, I'm sure. In fact, probably quoting Naomi Klein, talking about never wasting a good crisis. Right? If
Exactly.
Massachusetts has a crisis coming in terms of generating. Replacing 645 megawatts of nuclear power, then this is a place, this is a battle that climate hawks should go after. And it is a
Exactly.
place that we've been building towards for several years, right? I think the political will is in place. There's enough people that care that this would be, of course, this is just Ted talking, right? I mean, but it seems to me this is a place that you could make some headway.
Exactly. And I love this line in the Bruce Maule piece in which he describes an exchange between Baker and Senator and State Senator Mark Pacheco of Taunton, in which Baker stated that he's not, quote, he's not throwing any technology off of his jumbo platter of energy options, although he didn't mention offshore wind when he listed his platter options. And you have to wonder, does he not like the taste? And if so, can we put some sauce, some sweetener on that
A little
particular piece and
Louisiana
put it back on
gumbo
his
there.
exact so you put it back on his plate and chow down basically, because it really tastes good and it's healthy and nutritious too.
Well, I have a feeling that the Pilgrim nuclear power station, that I keep trying to call Pilgrim Point for some reason, but the Pilgrim nuclear power station, that is going to go offline is going to be a continuing topic of discussion. But you heard it here first, that this is an opportunity for climate hawks to get in there and demand that all of that power be replaced with clean energy, because we can do it. Not impossible. It's ambitious, but it's not impossible.
Exactly.
So, all right. So, we'll check that one, check off that topic, and we'll move on to our second topic. Again, this is now fallout from last week, where these events keep, you know, the news cycle keeps churning. So we know that one of the presidential candidates has said that she will not support Keystone XL. We have found that the kayaktivists up in Seattle have basically scared Royal Dutch Shell into doing nothing. Exactly. And you and I talked last week about whether or not Keystone's dead, right? Dead as a doornail now, because, you know, it ain't going to happen. What's next for climate hawks? So have you seen anything, D.I.? You tell me. What's next, queued up next for the ambitious climate hawk who feels as if she has got some victories under her belt, has learned how to do play the game, and wants to go, you know, slay bigger dragons?
Well, there's a great piece by Ben Adler in Grist talking about how, on the heels of the decision by presidential candidate Hillary Clinton not to support Keystone XL, and on the heels of Shell deciding to check out of the Chukchi Sea, there's
you can say that, not me.
There's now a push by climate activists to try to stop the exploitation of fossil fuel on federally owned deposits of oil, gas, and coal. This is the next frontier. That you know, in order to keep carbon in the ground, you have to basically push back against this effort to sort of tear apart public lands to sort of squeeze out every last bit of carbon, and that this is going to be the focus now. And it's, and now that you've seen the success of activism, you've seen multiple times now, whether it's the divestment movement or the Keystone XL decision or the Shell decision, you see that that hard work and organizing pays off. This is going to be the next frontier of making sure that carbon stays in the ground. It's going to be one more example of power conceding nothing without a demand.
So let's unpack that whole thing a little bit and remind people what's going on. So out in the western part of the United States, in the Chukchi Sea and most of Alaska, all on the eastern seaboard, the federal government owns huge tracts of land, right? That's part of the sort of sagebrush rebellion out west, that they resent the fact that the feds own so much property. But on those federal lands, there are large numbers of fossil fuel resources, right, or opportunities. And those coal mines and fracking wells on publicly owned lands, that is to say lands that you and I and the guy driving down the street, we all own because we're all Americans. Those things get sold at rock bottom prices to private corporations so they can go in and extract the fossil fuels and destroy the planet. And that needs to be, but also can be stopped by people demanding it, right?
Exactly. And Ben Adler's piece discusses the sort of, I guess you could say, for want of a better word, scorn that Interior Secretary Sally Jewell directed towards those who are encouraging the Obama administration to sort of stop all this leasing of public lands for fossil fuel exploitation. And a lot of the climate activist groups are basically saying that, you know, that they're going to make their voices heard and heard louder and heard louder, because in order for the administration to have any kind of credibility on climate, they basically have to tell these companies that want to get all that carbon, no, you can't have it. This is a public land for the public good, not for private good, not for exploitation. And we have a moral obligation to protect the atmosphere, not to pollute it.
And just to remind people, so that this, this is not what I'm advocating, at least not yet, but Tim DeChristopher, who is a hero of the climate movement, he was a guy who went into a auction of federal parcels for oil companies, right? He went into the federal auction and put in somehow bogus bids or something, or bid millions of dollars, and basically screwed up an entire federal government auction of fossil fuel parcels, right? And he almost went to jail for it. But that is kind of the beginning, or to my mind, this sort of time zero of opposition to using the federal lands to pull fossil fuels out of, because there's a lot, right?
It was such a shame that he was prosecuted for that for no reason at all, for a simple act of disobedience. He was in a real way a political prisoner in this country, and now that he's out, he has for the past couple of years just been a passionate advocate for the sort of civil disobedience. And I think he inspired the I think it was Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara,
The lobster boat guys
the
that we
lobster
talked
boat
about last year, yeah.
guys who basically took a stand and received international attention when the then prosecutor Samuel Sutter decided not to pursue charges against them because he recognized the importance of what they were doing. So again, civil disobedience works, it pays off, it has its benefits, and
And there's
it's
lots of
going to
stuff
be
you can do short of civil disobedience. I
exactly
mean,
exactly
there's much more mundane places we can all begin.
The spirit of Henry David Thoreau lives on,
That's
and
on.
it's handed down from generation to generation. Every gener I think it was Tom Steyer that did an interview recently on MSNBC where he said that every generation has a great challenge, and of course every generation has to meet that challenge, and those who are engaging in this sort of civil disobedience are meeting that challenge and beating it back.
Well, so we got to leave it there, but I would just say this week there are two big take-home lessons that I think are going to echo and we'll be talking about over the next few years. One is the challenge presented to Massachusetts by the closure of the nuclear power plant, and of course that's a template for lots of other places. And then the second thing that's going to keep echoing through our discussions is what are we going to do about federal lands and how come we are taking fossil fuels out of federal lands out west and in the along the east coast on the in the seaboard on the east coast and stopping that. So two big ideas, and we'll put a stake in the ground and say that we talked about them first on October 1st, 2015, right?
Exactly.
So to everyone that's listening in, you we'll put up the links to most of what we talked about on the blog. Of course, it's a blog at massclimateaction.net/blog. You can go there. That's where all the live links are. You can find we post that blog up to our Facebook page. It's slash Mass Climate Action. Please go there, share it with your friends, and take a listen. That Facebook page will bring you to the SoundCloud site where you can play. Additionally, you can listen to us directly on your iPhone using Stitcher. And TuneIn Radio and iTunes, of course, and that all comes through our Podbean account. So you can find all those things online easy enough. You're all smart enough to Google. They're all there. There's lots of ways to listen to the Climate Minute, and I encourage you to do that and tell your friends about it. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.